Matthew chapter 20, verses 20 through 28. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons, and kneeling down, asked a favor of him. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." "You don't know what you are asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup I am going to drink?" "We can," they answered. But Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great amongst you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Praise God.
I want to thank you for your prayers for Janet Sullivan and Cindy Hayes. I know this news has kind of rocked all of us over the last couple of weeks as we've heard about these two sisters and their battle now against cancer, and they haven't been able to be with us for the past few weeks. And I've talked to Michael and to Greg, and both of them want to convey their love for the congregation, their hope, their belief, the desire that they want you to pray for them, for their wives. And also, I just want to let you know that there are, in the lives of these two sisters, you know, one of the things that you see is how they are such a part of this congregation, and now in this moment, how people are responding to them, and members, sisters, brothers in this church, and how they are reaching out to those families. So they haven't been able to be here with us, and I know you're anxious about them and want to see them and want them to be here with us. But I will let you know that there are your brothers and sisters of this church who are ministering to them, who are loving them on your behalf, caring for them. And so let's continue to pray for them now. And we pray that they will be back among us soon. We can see them and hold them and love them ourselves. But these are long journeys that people go on. But both of these women are also just wonderful examples of the kind of text that we're talking about today, people who we look at and say, where is true greatness found? So this is our text here in Matthew 20 that Robert read. In it, the mother of James and John comes to Jesus, bows down before him, and asks him a very, very big favor. "Grant these sons of mine may sit at your right and your left in your kingdom." That's a big ask, isn't it? You know, Jesus before had said that these two are sons of thunder. And I guess we know now who he was referring to as thunder, right? She must be Miss Thunder. The Gospel of Mark kind of gives us a bit of a different take on this and says that the brothers themselves came to Jesus with this request. So all three of them are in on it, I guess, somehow. And I want to ask, what are James and John and Mama Thunder thinking here? What's on their mind? What are they thinking about? We might, for one thing, we might notice just one chapter before, chapter 19, in Matthew, Jesus had made a stunning promise to his disciples. Jesus had said, "In God's great new world, when the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne, those of you who have followed me will sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." What a promise. Talking about thrones gathered here. And, you know, so we might not like their ambition, but they took Jesus seriously. They believed this was going to happen. They take him seriously. But they didn't take him literally. He couldn't have meant that stuff that he said about torture and crosses and death. He couldn't have meant that literally and still had a kingdom, right? So what's going on here in this family? Well, before we pass them off as just some dysfunctional family, we should consider if there may not be something more going on in their life that's true about discipleship itself. James and John had spent years with Jesus. They are among the very first followers of Jesus. They'd been chosen and called by Jesus himself. They were two of the three followers who are allowed to witness the raising from death to life of a little girl. They're two of the three who were invited to witness the transfiguration. There they see Jesus surrounded by Moses and Elijah. And they're going to be there, two of the three again, along with Peter, when Jesus goes to pray in Gethsemane. So they form an inner circle. They've got a tight relationship with Jesus. James and John might think, you know, they've got a pretty good reason to think they're among the best followers, the best disciples that Jesus has. Maybe they at least have come to think that they know better than most of the rest of this gang. After all, it's not Jesus that they're trying to get ahead of. It's the rest of this crew of disciples. And they haven't looked very impressive up to this point. So maybe their ambitious plan, their mother's ambitious request, is a product of their own success at following Jesus. Maybe it's part of their journey of following Jesus. You know, one of the challenges of spiritual growth, and spiritual growth is a never-ending process that we go through. There are cycles, ups and downs, and it's a constant lifetime of spiritual growth. But a part of that process is that there is a danger in spiritual success. There's a danger even in living the Christian life well, as we should know, who follow a Christ who carried a cross. Maybe it's the success that you have in conquering the demons that plague your life. And now people see how different your life is. Or maybe it's the success that you have that's led you to be seen as a model of what a Christian should look like. Maybe it's the success in getting involved in things that you deeply believe and come to know to be the work of Christ and experiencing all of the exhilaration that comes from that. It's success, but even healthy spiritual growth is a challenge. It can produce unhealthy pride. It can produce ambition in us. When we think that we finally know something, we tend to think that, well, maybe there's little left for us to learn. When we think that we've arrived, we think, well, there's no reason to go anywhere else. When we think that we've got something figured out, we think everybody should think just exactly the way that we do. When we think that we're doing the right thing, you know, it's tempting to think, and maybe right to think, that it's the thing for everybody else to do. It's right at least about 50% of the time, so it doesn't really help you judge very well. Spiritual success is good, but in itself, it leads to its own temptations. How are we going to handle that? How are you going to handle that? How do you desire to do well for God's glory and not for your own glory? How do you arrive somewhere that you've been led by God in your life and then not refuse when God says, I want you to pick up and move a little further, or a little over here, or a long way away? It's very challenging. Well, whatever the origins of his disciples' ambition, Jesus' response to them is a wonderful guide both in what he says and in the how he says it. He corrects them without crushing them. He chooses to teach them instead of to chastise them. He preserves the integrity of the person instead of trying to dominate them and force them. He deals with the from them or to them with a position of love and a position of his relationship with them rather than the position of power and authority over him. He illustrates by his own actions exactly how he wants his followers to act. He is a servant to them, even when he teaches them. He reminds them that people who live according to the world's ways are the ones who are going to struggle and vie for power and prestige. And really nothing has changed, has it? We know this story. We experience this struggle in our own lives. We see it in the world around us. You got to keep climbing, the ladders that are out there. It seems like in the world you're born and your parents vie to get you in the right school. And then while you're there, you start, you're ranked, ordered, and one person is ahead of the other. And it's all about performance. And, well, I guess it should be about performance, but it seems to build into us this idea that that's kind of what life is all about. It's all about, performance. And that means that I have to be ahead of somebody else. I might have to be over somebody else. That's how you success in our minds almost translates to who am I over? That's success. We think of life like it's just a fixed sum game. It's one big pie. I'm going to get, my piece of it. And once somebody else gets their piece of it, there's less for everybody else. So, you have to compete. And that's kind of the way it's kind of built into us. If you have to climb over a few other people to get what you want, that's just the way the world is. Somebody has to dominate. Might as well be me. And Jesus stops them and says, "Not so with you. Not so." He says, "If you want to be great, be a servant." And then notice how he ramps this up. If you want to be first or greatest, be the slave of all. From great, then be a servant, to greatest, then be a slave. You see the thought process there? He says, the world seems to operate one way. Not so with you. This is not just a rule laid down for a particular person, James and John and their mom, or this situation. It's expected of every disciple of Christ at all times, in the church, out of the church. It's not going to be that way with you. Not because Jesus is going to force this behavior on us, but because he's trying to show us that there is a reality of the way the world actually works. We think it's this way. He says, no, the world actually works another way. If you want to have my life, you've got to live my way. What life do you want? On Sunday mornings during class time, I like to walk around and just look in on everybody's class. And I really like to go downstairs and I look in on the kids' classes. This is an old habit of mine that has not died yet. And my favorite place to go, and the place that I usually stop for a few minutes and just watch through the windows, is downstairs on the kids' wing as you would go out the door at the very end of the hallway. And on one side is Lolita's class, and on the other side is Richard's class. And Lolita's got the twos and the threes over here, and Richard has got the fours and the fives over on the other side. And that's where I like to go kind of hang out for a few minutes during class time. on Lolita's side. Her voice floats through the door. You know Lolita's voice. Is she here today? You know her voice. It's so beautiful. It's so warm. It just communicates love. And I like to watch in and hear her voice, and she's talking to the children, and they're doing, you know, things, and she's teaching them or something. But just her voice, and I just think how happy those children look. How loved they must feel to have her, to hear that voice. On the other side, Richard, your class, I look in on you, and almost always whenever I look in on Richard's class, the kids are just gathered in this tight circle around him. And they're looking at him with these faces. They're listening so intently to him. And still, and they're listening to him. I know they're not always still, but when I look in, Richard, they're just looking at you and listening to you. And you're quieter, and I don't hear you, and I don't hear what you're saying. But just the expressions on their faces. And they're still. And these are 4 and 5 year olds, people. Okay, so what are you doing in there? How do you do that? And I think, you know, Lolita has been teaching that class. I think Allie was one of her first students. So that would have been when you were about 2. So about 24 years ago. You are 26, aren't you? Oh, 27, darn. So 25 years ago. And Richard, I think you've been teaching kids for 35 years or so. And you've been teaching that class for over 20 years, something like that. I just want you to think about that for just a moment. Yeah, I think it deserves an applause. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think if Christian teaching is about loving people like Christ loves them, and shaping people into the image of Christ, I want you to just think about the impact that they have had on the church, on this congregation, on people who are now out and away from this congregation in many other places right now. I go and I stand down there because I want to be reminded of where the most important work happens most Sundays here. It's right there. Is it very visible to you? Is it something that we talk about a lot? Is it something you've seen? Have you been there since your child was 4 or 5? But it's there. It's small. It's humble. But it's probably the most powerful thing that happens here every week. Thank you for what you do. People who are true servants of Christ are going to leave a legacy in this world. They're going to leave their mark on this world. Jesus left a group of people who changed the world because he was a servant, not in spite of the fact that he was a servant. And if the kingdom of God is going to keep coming on earth as it is in heaven, may that be so. It's going to be because followers of Jesus keep giving themselves as servants, not in spite of it. That's the program. It's true, whatever job you do, it's done for God. Whether it's out of this building or in this building, it's out there in your neighborhoods. The jobs that you do at school, kids, make an impact on the people in your school. The jobs that you do in your homes. The jobs that you do in your neighborhoods and the places that you go and work. They make an impact on the people there. Jesus says there's no other way to change the world as he wants to change the world. The Son of Man didn't come to have servants obey him, but to be a servant and to give his life as a ransom for many. If you're going to line up behind Jesus, you have to line up as a servant. I think in order to fathom just the full depth of what Jesus means by asking us to be servants and slaves, we've got to recognize what he means when he talks about, in this passage, the cup. His cup is a way of speaking of his future suffering and his death. It's his destiny. And that's why when they ask to be at his left and his right when he comes as a king, Jesus says, "You don't know what you're asking." He was horrified. This was not a, "You don't know what you're asking." He was horrified. This was horrible. Because in just a few days' time, when Jesus does come in his glory, and when he fulfills his vocation, and when he is raised up as the King of creation, and when the love of God for this world is expressed most vividly, plainly, now you see it, he's going to be on a cross. And who is going to be at his right hand? And who is going to be at his left hand? And the mother of James and John, the Gospels tell us, is there. And she's watching this. She's there. And when she looks at his left and she looks at his right, who is she going to see? I think in spite of her, it's easy to cast aspersions at these disciples in Scripture and look at them and say, "Oh, they're so dumb. How did they do that?" Look at them and think, "How can they be so lacking in humility?" But don't forget, she followed Jesus all the way to the cross. She was there. She was following. And apparently, she's there at the tomb when they go and they find the stone rolled away. She had her bad moments. Just like the rest of us, she is not perfect, but she followed all the way to the cross. And sometimes, you know, discipleship, what it means is not that you can see the future and you know how it's all going to work out, but it's just that you are willing to put one foot in front of the other today to follow Jesus. Just one foot in front of the other. I'm so glad we don't have to see farther than that. It would be so intimidating. One foot in front of the other. That's the reality of discipleship. Discipleship is going to lead us to many paths. It's certainly going to lead us to places where we have to deny ourselves, places where there will be suffering of some kind or another, before it's going to lead to anything that resembles glory. Glory seems like a word not in our realm of being able to touch it and hold it. Hearing that that's the way discipleship is going to go is a difficult thing for us, and Jesus breaks it to us gently. He must have broken it to them gently. Can you drink the cup I drink? Can you drink this cup yourself? There's suffering left in Jesus' cup. There are dregs there in the cup left for his followers, for you, for me, to drink. And they reply, they're prepared to drink his cup. As we reply when we're baptized, and each day as we renew ourselves, yes, we're prepared to drink your cup, Jesus. But are we? Can't see that end result. Can we put one foot in front of the other? And they did drink his cup. They did drink his cup. The book of Acts tells us one of these brothers, James, was killed by King Herod. That's it. The other brother, John, he drops out of the record in Acts, kind of just mysteriously. And later traditions place him in exile on the island of Patmos for being a follower of Christ. And Of course, there are some books or letters in our Bible that are attributed to him. There's other legends, other church tradition that tells us that he had died years before, martyred just like his brother. We're not quite sure. But they drank the cup. Both of these brothers drank the cup. I'll bet their mother drank the cup. They shared Jesus' life. If they shared Jesus' life, they had to drink the cup. They had to be a servant to God's creation. They had to be a slave to God's will. They drank the cup. That's the destiny at some level for each of us as a Christian if we take up this cross of discipleship. An ancient Greek philosopher expressed the view of his time, and I'm sure you will recognize it as completely in tune with our time, when he said, "How could anyone be happy when he's the slave of anyone else at all?" Yeah. And here we have a king, as Christians, who says, "Not so with you." Instead, who says, "How could anyone be happy unless he's the servant of everyone else?" What a radical redefinition of happiness that is. It's too radical for me so much of the time. Too radical maybe for you too. Too radical maybe for this world. Too wide a ditch to try to jump all at once. But can we put one foot in front of the other in discipleship today? I'm so glad that's all we're asked to do. We're not asked to leap over. Very seldom. Big, wide, ugly ditches of life. Sometimes we find ourselves right down in the bottom of one. But to get out of it, you have to put, typically, one foot of discipleship right after the other. That's the way life is. Every one of us is asked to take a step today. And maybe for you, that's just going to serve the city day. Or maybe it's something that only you know about. Or maybe it's the step of discipleship that leads you to baptism. Proclaiming in front of everyone here in this body that you'll follow Jesus. Only, you know, really you can be responsible for that and know that. But if we follow that way, the promises are great. The promises are wonderful. Thrones? The best part of it, though, is not the throne part. The best part of it is we will be with Jesus. That's where we're all being brought together. That's how we'll be brought together. We'll meet at Jesus. If there's any way we can help you today, come as we stand and sing this one more song.